hemorrhoids can be a real pain in the butt, causing anal itching and burning and irritation. Get fast relief with all-natural, doctor-developed and tested Anacool. Buy Anacool, A-N-A-C-O-O-L, on Amazon right now and save 15% with code WABC2024.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Hello, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. As always, it's a great pleasure to be with you. And by the by, you can listen to us on the Internet, live streaming on the Internet, called LarryKudlowShow.com, LarryKudlowShow.com. You can hear us all across the country, throughout the world, throughout the solar system, and the Milky Way. All those. You can't miss it. And during the week, please, Fox Business Network, the name of the show is Kudlow. It plays at 4 to 5 p.m. every day, Monday through Friday. I know I took Good Friday off, but I'll be back on Monday, 4 to 5 p.m. And if for some crazy reason you can't be there at 4, just text your favorite 9-year-old, and she will show you how to DVR the show. And you'll never miss a thing. Okay, I want to talk here at the opening. I know this is Saturday, and Donald Trump's indictment and charges, or the lack thereof, were Tuesday. But I'm going to talk some more about that because it's such a huge event. And I think Mr. Trump really did a great job abiding by the law. I mean, he showed up, abide by the law, in the courtroom. There was some speculation he wouldn't, but he did. But the main thing here, the main point I want to make is that Donald Trump stood tall, okay? He stood tall, unflinching, as these crazy far-left, woke, progressive Democrats are trying to destroy him, which is what they're trying to do, which is what they've always tried to do. From the moment he came down the escalator in Trump Tower in the summer of 2015, they have tried to destroy him. They have not. They have not destroyed him, in my judgment, nor will they. And moreover, he is not going to let the country surrender to these left-wing political forces that basically hate freedom. They hate democracy. Trump will fight it because that's his nature. He's the greatest fighter for freedom in this country, and he will not surrender. He will not. I know him. I worked for him for 3 years. The presidential race will be the presidential race. We have a bunch of guests today that are going to talk about that, what his polls look like. Some Democrats think he's the best candidate for Joe Biden to beat. I don't have that point of view, but I'm not taking sides right now in the presidential race. I'm just looking at Donald Trump's greatness. He stood up unflinchingly, and he will not allow the left to destroy him. He is a defender of law and order and democracy. And by the by, without getting too legal, because I'm not a lawyer, fact is, Alvin Bragg, this crazy left-wing progressive Democrat who ran against Trump. He didn't run as a prosecutor. He ran to get Trump. I mean, the indictment was just awful. Talks about a felony falsification of records, business records, Trump Corporation business records, a felony falsification. They've never proven that. They've never proven that. They've never proven that there were any false entries into these business records. But here's the key point. Bragg is trying to say that they falsified the business records with an intent to defraud that specifically included trying to commit another crime or aid or conceal the commission of that other crime. So just to be real simple, the charge here is former President Trump falsified business records of his company, which is privately owned, and he did that with the intent to commit another crime. But the indictment never, at no point, specifies what that crime is. There's no crime. What, excuse me, Bragg, what's the crime? Yes, he never said it. He has 34 counts business records, which is stupid in the first place, should only have one. But putting that aside, what is the crime that Trump intended to commit because he allegedly falsified his business records of the company he owns? And it has nothing to do with election law. And we will have Brad Smith on at the half hour to talk about that. He's a former member of the Federal Election Commission. He's now teaching law. Point is, Bragg never showed a crime. So we went through this whole thing. No, there. But then I think I want to skip to Mar-a-Lago and Mr. Trump's speech Tuesday night, which I thought was one of the best speeches he's ever made. And again, it shows you how tall he's standing despite this left-wing assault. He was restrained, but he made important points. Basically, he will never let the country surrender to whatever left-wing political forces hate freedom, who hate democracy. He will not surrender to the politicalization of our entire criminal law justice system. He will not. Or the weaponization of our justice system. Or the weaponization used by the Department of Justice itself, as well as U.S. attorneys, Democrat U.S. attorneys, and little nothingheimers like this Alvin Bragg of New York, who was so pathetic in his indictment, which was so incorrect. Here's one section of Trump's superb speech at Mar-a-Lago Tuesday night. I will quote, "We are a nation in decline, and now these radical left lunatics want to interfere with our elections by using law enforcement. We can't let that happen. With all this being said, and with a very dark cloud over our beloved country, I have no doubt, nevertheless, that we will make America great again." This is Trump at Mar-a-Lago on his speech Tuesday night. "With all the dark cloud hanging over our beloved country, I have no doubts, nevertheless, that we will make America great again. This is a man who will not surrender, and he will not allow the left-wing takeover of our entire legal and judicial system." And I just want to say, America has always been a nation of laws. We've always prided ourselves that we abide by the rule of law. And I want to say, in economics, okay, this is predominantly an economics show, remember, America has always distinguished itself by observing private property rights. Private property rights, and hence the rule of law in all our transactions. Private property rights go all the way back to the founding fathers 250 years ago. It's the basis of free market economics. It's the basis of free market capitalism, private property. And in the rest of the world, by the way, almost everywhere in the rest of the world, with the exception of Great Britain, all the European countries, Latin America, Asia, the government has the private property rights, not private business or landowners or farmers or financiers or entrepreneurs. But in this country, it is the individual and the property owner, the property rights, who take precedence in our court system. And again, that is borrowed from Magna Carta, basically, in Great Britain. That's where that all began and evolved, from British law, but not Europe. The second point I want to make in Trump's superb speech is tough words on the economy. Quote, with all we did on energy, on the military, or big tax cuts, or deregulation, he said, with all that, now the U.S. is in a mess. That's Biden's mess. Our economy is crashing. Inflation is out of control. Our currency is crashing and will soon no longer be the world standard. And then He gave up on energy independence and energy dominance. Now, this is important. This is my neck of the woods. I was the NEC director, National Economic Council director. This is Mr. Trump saying, if he were reelected, he will go back to tax cuts. He will go back to the deregulation of business and energy. He will make sure the dollar, king dollar, is strong and remains the world's reserve currency and fight hard for energy independence. By the way, I want to add, Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise and the House Republicans have an excellent bill, H.R. 1. H.R. 1 was my idea going back to the November election. They've given me credit for it, but that's not important. H.R. 1 would give us back our energy independence, would free up, reopen the spigots for all the above, fossil fuels as well as renewables. Biden has driven the economy into a ditch. I mean, Biden's embraced this progressive, far-left idea of modern monetary theory. You can spend whatever you want. You can borrow. Deficits, debt, money printing, anything you want. Redistribution, no harm. Well, it's wrong because the economy is now on the verge of recession and the inflation rate has soared. It's come down a bit, but still harmful. 22 months, the consumer price index is growing faster than real worker wages. Real wages have fallen 22 months for the typical American family, the blue collar. And I might add, it's just worse for the lower income people who have to pay this high cost of living and watch their standard of living decline because the dollars in their pockets are worth less. We'll talk about the dollar later in the show. It's a very important story. But just to say, two points that Mr. Trump made in Mar-a-Lago. One, he will fight to stop the politicalization, the weaponization of our legal and judicial system. He will fight to stop. He will never, never allow the Alvin Braggs of the world or the Merrick Garlands of the world or the Joe Bidens of the world to politicize the judicial and legal system for their own left-wing aims. He will not allow that. And second, he will fight to restore the kind of economic growth and prosperity agenda that he successfully implemented in his first term on lower taxes, on deregulation, on energy independence, on king dollar, on low inflation. He will fight back what Joe Biden has overturned in just a little more than 2 years. So the integrity of our judicial and legal system, and the strength of our economy. And remember, it was the middle class and the lower classes and the minority groups, the blacks, the browns, the Asians, the women. They're the ones who benefited the most from Trump's tax cuts. You can look that up. From Trump's business deregulation. You can look up those statistics, even though Biden lies about them continuously. The facts are there. And Trump stood tall. I'll just say that again. He stood tall. I don't know the outcome of this. I mean, the next time in court is December 6th. I'm not sure it'll ever get to court. I'm certain it'll be overturned, but I'm not the lawyer. I'm just saying Trump laid down his own laws to keep American freedom, to keep our democracy sound, to stop the left-wing politicalization, to stop the destruction of our economy and our currency, and to make us strong around the world. Trump stood tall and will not stop fighting. I'm Kudlow. We'll take a pause here and be back.
Hemorrhoids can be a real pain in the butt, causing anal itching and burning and irritation. Get fast relief with all-natural, doctor-developed and tested Anacool by Anacool, A-N-A-C-O-O-L, on Amazon right now and save 15% with code WABC2024.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I want to switch gears a little bit from Mr. Trump standing tall. And we're going to come back, Mr. Bradley Smith, who was on the Federal Election Commission not too long ago. We'll talk some more about the Trump case, the pathetic Trump case. But one other quick thing. There's a lot of stuff in the papers and TV and whatnot about the U.S. dollar falling. And somehow it's going to be replaced by the Chinese yuan or Chinese renminbi. Ain't going to happen. All right. That's my first point. Ain't going to happen. I call it King Dollar. That's a phrase that I coined back in the early 90s, which stuck. But look, 90% of the world's transactions are in dollars. Okay. 90%. It's like $6.6 trillion worth on a daily basis. Goods, services, financial, you name it. 90%. So the dollar is, you know, the most important currency and will remain so for a long time and probably forever, but nothing's forever. Some people said, well, the dollar as a foreign exchange reserves for central banks has dropped from about 70% to a little less than 60% in the last 20 years. But that's just kind of a theoretical notion. These central banks diversify their portfolios. That really doesn't tell you much of anything. It's the transactions, basically the utility of the dollar, the medium of exchange. But the point I want to make is we shouldn't be worried. I'm not worried about the Chinese yuan. They have capital controls. It's a state-run economy. There are only a few heavily controlled investment firms in China. I mean, you just don't want to park your money in China. I mean, if the Saudis want to sell oil to China and take some yuan, that's fine. But they'll convert it to dollars. The only ones kind of stuck in that is Russia. But again, the yuan is like less than 1% of the world's transactions. But again, if you're worried about the health of King Dollar, as I am, you know, then the phrase is, we have seen the enemy and the enemy is us. Okay, if the United States government, if the Bidens in particular, and Trump mentioned this, because Trump, when I worked with him, Trump was very keen on keeping the dollar the number one currency in the world, the standard monetary standard. He understood that a great country should have a great currency. But if we inflate, if we spend, overspend, if we overborrow, if we over-deficit, if we over-tax, if we over-regulate, if we over-money creation, and we generate more inflation, then the dollar will sink. Interestingly, I'm not sure why this is, but since last October, the dollar's lost about 15%, and the price of gold's gone up about 20%, 18%. Gold's over $2,000 an ounce. And on the foreign exchange markets, the dollar, so-called DXY, has fallen almost back to 100 or 101. It was about 115. So that, you know, Biden keeps telling us he's cutting deficits, and the Federal Reserve keeps saying they're cutting inflation by reducing the money supply. That may be true or not true. It may be false. And anyway, there's no confidence in Joe Biden's administration, so people may not want to hold dollars as much as usual. So the enemy is us. If we spend, borrow, print money, then we're going to see King Dollar sink. It's not that the other currencies are so great. Right now, we're the worst of the bad lot. We're the best of the worst lot. But the point is, we would destroy the dollar right here. We don't need China's help. We'll destroy the dollar. So I want to keep King Dollar alive. I'd love to link the dollar to gold or some broad commodity index to make it as sound as can be. We'll talk some more about that King Dollar stuff over the course of the show. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back with Mr. Brad Smith to talk about this stupid Trump lawsuit by this left-wing Alvin Bragg.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. And I want to talk some more about this Trump indictment and all the flaws and problems with it. So we're going to bring in Bradley Smith. Brad Smith's Capital University professor of law, and he's chairman and founder of the Institute for Free Speech. He's the co-author of Voting Rights and Election Law, and he's a former Federal Election Commission commissioner. Oh, Brad, were you the chairman of that commission? Or
I was chairman in 2004.
There you go. So he was the big dog in 2004. And I'm reading in the Wall Street Journal about a week ago, Trump indictment is a perversion of campaign finance law. And then the subheader, if a candidate has to pay for his own clothes, surely hush money is likewise a personal expense. I would only say we don't even know about the recording of the hush money and all that. But what's wrong with Alvin Bragg's idea? He didn't even specify a crime, Brad. I mean, that's the most incredible thing. But you take it from there. Tell us what the problems are.
Right. So, again, let's go over the basic charge that Bragg is making is that Trump falsified business records. But that's chump change. That's a misdemeanor. The statute of limitations is long past. And, you know, people, Trump's detractors don't want to see him charged with a falsification of business records. They want something that's a felony. You know, they want to see him in cuffs and in jail. And what arguably can make it a felony, or at least what Bragg says can make it a felony, is that under New York law, if you commit a crime, falsification of business records, I should say, to cover up a crime, then it becomes a felony. Jail time is a possibility and so on. Statute of limitations is longer and so on. And so what is the other crime that was being covered up? Well, as you point out, Larry, the indictment doesn't really say very clearly, but the way the facts are stated and everything we've heard suggests that what Bragg is saying is the other crime that was covered up was Federal Election Campaign Act crimes of not reporting a campaign contribution. Now, there are so many problems with this. I mean, first of all, even if this were a problem, typically failure to accurately report federal election expenditures is a civil penalty, not a criminal charge. But let's suppose that we want to charge it criminally. What is the crime? Well, it's not reporting campaign expenditure. The hush money was a campaign expenditure. How does Bragg get there? He says, well, the law says that anything for the purpose of influencing an election is a contribution or an expenditure. And Trump paid this to try to influence his election. Therefore, case closed. I win. The problem is that that's not really how the law works. That's not how it's read. It does use that language. No doubt about that. That's an absolute quote, you know, for the purpose of influencing the election. But the standard doesn't mean, you know, the subjective purpose of the person acting. It means what is the objective purpose? You know, what is a list of things that you spend money on in campaigns? So you don't buy campaign ads if you're not running for Congress. You don't open a campaign headquarters if you're not running for Congress. You don't hire a campaign manager if you're not running for Congress. Those are the kinds of things that are campaigns that are for the purpose.
So there's no doubt.
The federal election.
Among those things, there's no doubt. Those are campaign related things.
Right. You don't do those if you're not running for office.
Right.
But a lot of things people do are for the purpose of influencing their election are not considered campaign expenditures by the FEC. Mm-hmm. Some of these are specifically excluded under the statute. For example, any item of personal clothing. So if you go out and decide, I got to upgrade my wardrobe so I look good on the campaign trail, your whole reason for doing that may be to influence the election, but it's not a campaign expenditure. Mm-hmm. Things like country club memberships and athletic tickets. So if you say, I need these to help me raise money for the campaign, I can take donors to the sporting event, they'll give me, you know, money for the campaign and so on. Not a campaign expense, even though the purpose for buying it was to influence the campaign. But what's in the statute is also not an exhaustive list. So there's all kinds of other things that would count. So let me give some examples that may seem more in touch with Mr. Trump's situation. If I had a messy divorce in my background and decided to run for Congress, I might pay a lawyer to try to seal up those divorce records. Mm. And my purpose for doing that would be to influence the campaign, but that would not be considered a campaign expenditure. Why? Because just like people buy clothes, whether they're running for office or not, some people will have to pay a lawyer for divorce proceedings and to seal those records and so on. It's not something that's caused by the act of campaigning. You choose to do it because you want to influence the election, but it's not caused by that. Or another, one more example is if you want to settle business disputes. Say you're a businessman, you own a couple restaurants, you have some complaints against you alleging racial discrimination in your restaurants. You think these claims are complete nonsense, but you don't want this, you know, being argued out in the press when you're running for office and accusations, oh, he's a racist and so on. And so you tell your corporate lawyer, you know, settle these allegations. And he may tell you, no, we shouldn't settle these. It's a great case. You say, I don't care. I'm running for office. I don't want these interfering. Your purpose in settling those and having the company settle those is to influence the campaign. But it's not a campaign expenditure. You can't have your campaign pay for it. And so Bragg's odd theory here.
Let me hang on. Because it affects your personal life. It's not just limited to a campaign. I mean, to be direct with Trump, the allegation is he falsified business records to cover up hush money payments, right? But I mean that itself will have to be proven in court. But I'm just saying, supposing that were true, he could be trying to cover up for personal reasons to save his marriage, his kids. He wanted to keep it out of the press. He told this guy Pecker from the National Enquirer. You buy it and then bury it, that kind of thing. It wasn't, in other words, he personally or reputationally would benefit. It wasn't directly. I've read your article so many times, I want to make sure I understand that. You know, I'm especially interested in the $6,000 bespoke suit. But putting that aside, do I have that right? In other words, it for personal use, if it helps your personal situation, it's not like hiring a campaign manager or buying a bunch of campaign pins. There's a difference here.
Right. Right. And the idea of the purpose isn't, you know, why you decided to do it. It's that objective notion, as you just described it. This is something that could benefit you, that people do, maybe not you, but somebody does this, even if they're not running for office.
Yep. Sure. I mean, I could buy my suit. I may wear it in a debate, but I may, you know, if I lose, I may wear that suit for the next 10 years. So I don't, it's not a campaign expenditure. I get that.
Right.
I didn't get it at first, but now I finally figured out. So this is so interesting to me. You were the head of the Federal Election Commission in 2004. That's an election year. Did you have any disputes that you had to arbitrate or decide on at that way back that? So that was Bush. Let me make sure. My friend George W. Bush, who remains a great friend of mine, and
Kerry. Kerry.
That's right. John Kerry, the crazy climate guy. So did you have anything you had to arbitrate or decide on?
Well, these kinds of claims, you know, if we're talking about this personal use type stuff, I don't remember that any came up in the presidential race that year.
Yeah.
But they do come up to the FEC. I don't want to say all the time. It's not like they're super frequent, but they're not the black swan or the unicorn either. I mean, you see these with some regularity. And candidates often want to push the envelope. They say, well, you know, I have to campaign a lot, so I need to hire a nanny to take care of my kids while I'm out campaigning. You know, not a campaign expense. And they'll do this with a lot of things like that, trying to push the envelope. And the danger here that people should realize is that we don't want a system in which you can spend your campaign funds for these things that benefit you personally, because you start to think of how that would very quickly open the door to widespread abuse. You know, I'm a fairly famous person. I want to have somebody else pay for a bunch of stuff. I declare myself running for office and I raise campaign funds and spend it for, you know, home security system. That's one thing we had requested at the FEC. I can spend it on, you know, legal fees that are very very tangentially related to me having held office in the past. And you get a lot of things like that. You know, that's not what we want. We don't want a candidate, for example, saying, well, you know, I took a donor down to the Super Bowl, you know, because it was a campaign expense because he was a donor. That's not what we want happening. So we actually don't want that. And like so much of what's going on here is that we're abandoning all kinds of sort of principles and what is our long-term interest in this, you know, attempt by, you know, folks to get Trump. They're kind of willing to abandon anything there to get him.
Brad, you got some more time. Can I take a commercial break and come back with you? You got a couple more minutes for us.
Sure,
you're terrific. Folks, we're talking to Bradley Smith, who's a Capital University professor of law and was former chairman of the Federal Election Commission, so he knows whereof he speaks. I'm Kudlow. We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
Larry Kudlow. From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're talking with Bradley Smith, who was a former chairman of the Federal Election Commission, which, of course, enters into this crazy Alvin Bragg indictment of Donald Trump. Anyway, Bradley Smith is a Capital University professor of law. He's the chairman and founder of the Institute for Free Speech, and he's the co-author of Voting Rights and Election Law. Brad, I want to ask you about this whole business that Alvin Bragg forgot to insert a crime into his charges against Donald Trump. So I'm reading our friend Andrew McCarthy, Bragg's indictment fails to state a crime not once but 34 times, blah, blah, blah. He talks about a felony falsification of records under New York Penal Code, but he has to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, beyond reasonable doubt, that Trump caused a false entry to be made in his business records and did so with an intent to defraud that specifically included trying to commit another crime. Nowhere in the indictment does the grand jury specify what other crime Trump fraudulently endeavored to commit. The presumption was this had something to do with federal election laws, but you're saying no. So what's the crime here?
Well, I mean, obviously what Bragg is going to try to do is convince a jury that this is a crime. And I do want to point out, I mean, there are people who argue the opposite. They say, no, if he intended to influence the election subjectively, it's a crime. Like I said, I don't think the law supports that. There's no, to my knowledge, any court opinion, no appellate court has ever made a ruling on that. It's worth noting that the FEC looked at this case and chose not to pursue it. So the FEC, I think, also does not see this as a crime. And that leads us to a couple of things that are worth mentioning. It gets kind of into the weeds of the law, but
I love the weeds. I love weeds.
There you go. Well, first, you know, is that there's what's called federal preemption. That is, a state can't have a law that contravenes a federal law. So, for example, in federal campaign finance law, you can give a candidate $3,300. New York couldn't pass a law saying it's illegal to give any candidate more than $2,000. Right? They can do that for state office, governor and stuff, but not for Congress, president, U.S. Senate. So here, you know, Bragg can't really have an interpretation of the law, I think, that is contrary to that of the, you know, the federal agencies that are supposed to be interpreting the law. So he's got that problem. Then he's got a problem under the Federal Judiciary Act of 1789. I mean, this is one of our oldest laws, right? 1789 is one of the first laws passed in the first Congress. And it says that all federal felonies are under the exclusive jurisdiction of federal courts. So it's very hard, you know. Now, what Bragg is going to argue, I'm not charging him with a federal crime. I'm charging him with a state crime of falsifying business records to cover up another crime. But because Trump has not been convicted of any other crime, to get there, I think he's going to have to prove that Trump violated federal law. And I think, and then, on the basis of being able to prove that, if he could, Trump would get jail time as opposed to a misdemeanor. Mm. That sounds an awful lot to me like using state court to prosecute a federal crime. And, you know, the Judiciary Act would seem to prohibit that. So there's all kinds of, you know, legal obstacles that pop up here beyond the basic FEC, you know, is this a violation of the Federal Election Campaign Act question?
Well, that's
and I don't know how Bray gets through them all.
Yeah, I mean, that, by the way, what you're saying is almost identical to what Andrew McCarthy writes in his Andy was a former prosecutor. You may know him. Smart guy, old friend of mine, National Review. But he was a prosecutor for many, many, many years. And you can't, you know, Trump's running for president. It's a federal office. So New York state law doesn't work. The other thing that McCarthy raises is that the Trump stuff wouldn't have been during the election. The reporting would have been in 2017, not 2016. So that's a problem. And then, of course, there's the issue of the statute of limitations. I mean, at what point that stuff is supposedly run out unless you're going to recreate. I mean, I don't understand. I'm not a lawyer, obviously. So Bragg's got the wrong court system, i.e. New York State versus federal. And I don't know. When does this? I thought 2 years for a misdemeanor. This 5 years for a felony. This stuff was 7 years ago, but it wouldn't have been reported even if it had done what Bragg wanted until 2017. So how could it influence the election when it would have been the year after the election?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things here. First, again, I'm not a criminal attorney, I need to point out, but yeah, on the statute of limitations, apparently Bragg has a theory that statute of limitations is told while Trump was continuously out of the state, and that gets this just barely within the statute of limitations. That's my understanding. Mm. I think he's got a real problem with that. Mm. And then you have the question of how does he, you know, turn this, you know, we're back to the question of how does this turn into a federal crime? And I just don't see how you make that stick. You can't, you know, hold Trump liable for a federal crime for something he hasn't been convicted of unless you're actually prosecuting him for that crime. And the idea that you could go, you know, essentially he'd be getting a jail term because he was prosecuted in state court and found to have violated a federal law. And that's a clear violation of the Judiciary Act. Like I said, 1789. It's one of the oldest governing statutes we have.
Mm. That's really fascinating. So what do you think, you know, why did they have to wait till December 4th? I mean, I got to tell you, again, as a total non-lawyer, I think what Bragg was doing here is assuaging all these far-left progressives who were yelling at him to get Trump. Like, that's what he campaigned on, but he didn't do it, and now he did it. I don't think he cares about the outcome. Honestly, I think he feels his work is done. He had his indictment. He had the president fingerprinted, blah, blah, blah. His news conference was pathetic, Bragg. He didn't even name a crime, couldn't find a crime. And I don't even know if it's going to get to court. He did what he wanted to do. He tried to embarrass Trump, and he knows damn well the law doesn't support it. That's my non-legal take. Now, I know I'm partial to Trump because I worked for him, but that's the way I see it, Brad. I mean, I got to tell you, this is just a lot of junk. Junk science,
right.
This is junk law.
I think it could be right. And on the question of the disclosure, you know, before the election, you're right that the reports would not actually have been filed till after the election.
Yeah.
Again, I think the theory they're working on, I want to give them every credit, you know, you can, is, well, yeah, but if he hadn't paid the money, Stormy Daniels would have started blabbing before the election, and therefore he was still trying to influence the election. You know, but you're right. It certainly takes out at that point. I don't know. I just like you. I'm just stunned by the weakness of this particular case on a whole number of fronts. And again, you know, my interest really is in you know, proper interpretation of campaign finance law. Mm-hmm. My professional career has been built around that.
Yeah, no, it's important. I want you to be objective. That's why we had you on our Fox Business show where you did great. Look, you know, it's Andy McCarthy. I don't think he necessarily wants Trump to be president. Andy's just, you know, I read him because he's so good as a former prosecutor, and his written work is so good. But I'm listening, you know, like Jonathan Turley, who really isn't political, you know, from George Washington University. You may have seen him on the air. He's not even political. And he's saying the same thing. So it just interests me that, And on the other side of the aisle, on the liberal left side of the aisle, I'm sure there's some people out there trying to make the case for Bragg, but I haven't seen many. I mean, I think the world was stunned at how weak it was and how weak Bragg's news conference was.
And you know what disappoints me, though, Larry, is that nobody – I mean, there are some Democratic lawyers and stuff who have come out pretty aggressively saying this is really overreach. But where's the prominent Democratic politician, you know, one Democratic senator or prominent member of the House who's going to come out and say, we've got to stop this never escalating warfare, which involves, you know, denigrating the rule of law and everything else. You know, where's one person who will come out and say that? And it's disappointing to me that we haven't seen that person yet.
That's a great, it's an important point because this thing is going to, it's going to fall into this abyss where Republican county, not even federal, Brad, but Republican county DAs are going to start making cases against, you know, public, higher office public Democrats.
Envision this example. What if Alabama passed a law saying it's a violation of the Alabama Penal Code to commit an impeachable offense while holding federal office? So then some DA down in Alabama starts prosecuting Biden, alleging he's committed some impeachable offense, even though, you know, the House hasn't voted on it, the Senate hasn't convicted him. But they start pursuing criminal violations against him. You know, you can't do that. And to me, that's kind of what they're trying to do up here in New York, what Bragg is trying to do. And,
I know.
But you're probably right. Bragg probably just wanted the initial headlines. And you know, note that this isn't even going to have another court hearing until December. So,
but I do think Trump has a point, a key point. The politicalization of the judicial system, it's just not good. It's not good. It's not what we want. Anyway, Bradley Smith, can't thank you enough for your time today. Former chairman of the Federal Election Commission back in 2004, teaching law at Capital University. Appreciate everything. All right, folks, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to have a good long look at the economy. What's going on? Inflation, recession, jobs, king dollar. We'll do it all for half hour, for heaven's sakes. I'm Kudlow. Stick around.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. Great pleasure to be with you. Let's talk about the economy. We just talked about the Trump fiasco. Let's go to the economy with, we got Michael Faulkender, professor of finance at the University of Maryland. He's chief economist at the America First Policy Institute and a former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy, and John Carney, Breitbart News Editor, Economics and Finance, and co-author of the Breitbart Business Digest. John Carney, what'd you learn from the employment report yesterday? It's kind of mensa. What'd you think?
So I thought that it was good enough to support the idea that the Fed is going to hike again. This is the last employment report that the Fed will be able to see before its next meeting in early May. And 236,000 jobs is a lot. I mean, Larry, when you were in the White House, you would have been quite happy with 236,000. It's cooler than we had in February or January, but it is still a quite hot jobs number. And the unemployment rate fell. I think Fed officials have to look at that and say, we are not getting a fast enough cool down in the labor market to satisfy their desire to have less demand for employment.
You know, I was reading your piece on Jim Bullard from the St. Louis Fed, who is pretty hawkish. What about, let me just ask, though, to follow up. Let's see. Average hourly earnings for production workers, 0.3 in March, 0.4 in February, 0.3. So 4.2% annually for the last 3 months, 5.1% for the last 12 months. So wages are cooling down. Of course, they're underneath the inflation rate. But wages look like they're cooling down. Does that play a role in this or no?
It does, and it's helpful that they're cooling down. But again, as you just said, 4.2% is far from being consistent with 2% inflation.
Mm.
And so the Fed has a long way to go. I don't think that this means they have to necessarily keep hiking as far as the eye can see. I do think that the current built-in expectations into things like the Fed funds futures market don't really make sense. They see they did move a little on these jobs numbers. They now favor a hike at the next meeting, and before it was about evenly split. They're moving, but they still think that right now built into the numbers is a hike at the May meeting, a pause at the June meeting, and then cuts for the rest of the year. That to me is not really in the cards unless we get some, you know, dramatic shift in the numbers, but I don't see that happening.
Mike Falkender, you know, you're still, even with a 3.5% unemployment rate, your participation rates are still low. Your employment to population ratio is still low. You know, we're quite, and also, Mike, if you look at the participation rate for prime age, whatever it is, 25 to 54 or something, that thing is still a couple of points below the peak of years ago. I mean, what's up with that? We've never really gotten back to peak rates. There's just too many people that are still out there don't seem to want to work.
I agree with you, but the prime labor force participation rate is where it was prior to the pandemic. So one does question. So you're right, it's at 83 right now. The peak was at 84.5 or so a number of years ago. But with the aging of the population, we're never going to get the labor force participation rate back to where it was prior to the pandemic. You know, I mean, with the baby boomers in prime retirement years, we're looking at a structural reduction in both the employment to population ratio and the average labor force participation rate for adults, which is why, just as you did, I've been focusing more on the prime one. But let me go back to the Fed. I'm hearing more and more discussion about whether they're going to revisit the 2% target.
Oh.
And so, you know, are they going to really bring it down to 2%? You know, that statement they put out where they revised monetary policy projections to now do average inflation targeting, clearly that's out the window. Because, you know, if they want to get down to an average of 2% over the last couple of years, they've got to bring it down well below 2%, and they can't even get it to 2. So I wonder whether they're going to revisit, and I'm hearing more people talk about, will they give up on getting down to 2% because the impact that even higher rates would have, not only on the economy, but also remember the losses that SVB took, the Fed is taking as well.
Right. Their portfolio is underwater.
Yes, it is.
Mark to market.
Mark
to market, the Fed's insolvent.
Correct.
What does that mean exactly?
It's just going to be a bookkeeping entry until rates get back to an upward sloping yield curve. But until then, they're going to no longer contribute to the Treasury. And so that's a reduction, that's an even further reduction in federal income receipts.
Jay Powell will be the worst CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank in history.
Well, and I've been talking to more and more people about how, you know, how much are you going to fault SVB for doing exactly what the Fed itself is
doing? Right. That's such a great story. I know, it's a bookkeeping entry. And what do they call it? Deferred assets? I mean, they don't have to mark to market, but
no, they're just going to take a negative equity position, and it doesn't seem to matter.
I just love that. I mean, that really shows the paucity of knowledge here. John Carney, manufacturing is definitely in a recession, and housing, which may or may not be coming back, but it's still in a recession too. But the manufacturing interests me a lot because that's so important to the economy. I know everybody says consumer spending is 2/3 of GDP and blah, blah, 70%. But actually, you look under the hood of these GDP accounts, it's business to business activity that really matters. And that stuff has been slumping badly. And manufacturing is the root cause of it. So we may be closer to recession than people think.
Manufacturing is definitely in a recession. And it seems to be deepening. We're still losing. So even these months where we're adding a lot of jobs overall, we're losing manufacturing jobs. If you look at the survey data, that shows that, you know, we've been in contraction for 5 months in manufacturing. All of the Fed regional surveys have been deeply underwater for quite some time. So, yes, and manufacturing is also tends to be a bellwether for the rest of the economy,
right.
Whereas the services sector can hold up for a little longer. You see a decline in manufacturing before you see a decline in other parts of the economy. And as you said, housing, yes, I've been writing, housing seems to have bottomed, but it is not, and maybe it's trending up a little, but we're still in a very low activity area in the housing sector right now. So we have two major parts of the economy that are slumping. It's very, and then all the other indicators we talk about all the time, the leading economic indicators, the inversion of the yield curve, all tell us, yes, a downturn is coming. But the amazing thing that keeps happening, and partly because of these jobs numbers we were just talking about, is that date keeps getting pushed further and further away. A lot of people thought we'd be in it in the first or second quarter. That now looks unlikely that we'll have a recession then. So we're talking third quarter, maybe. Most likely, I think now, fourth quarter or first quarter of next year.
Mike Falkender, if you were still the top economist in the Treasury Department, which is a very lofty position, and we were having our meetings with Kevin Hassett and me and you and even Mnuchin, what would your recession outlook, what would you be advising us?
I'm with John. It keeps coming back to, when are households going to finish burning through the money that they accumulated during pandemic? Mm. More and more of them are hitting credit card debt limits, and we've been watching that checking and savings accounts deposits at banks have been slowly declining. There was about a 40% increase between the end of 2019 and 2022. That number has started to come down, probably hasn't come down enough yet, and so people are still spending the money on restaurants, vacations, and services. It's when that spending stops that we'll hit a recession, and we will, right? Because when you've got negative real wages and you've got savings rates where they're at, a lot of households are burning through the cash that they have accumulated. Question is, when will they burn through enough of it that they'll be forced to pull back? And we'll get the inevitable recession. It'll be shallow, but we will get it because people will pull back because the current spending levels are unsustainable in a negative real wage environment.
John Carney, before we take a break, I want to go back to your favorite and become my favorite inflation indicator, which is the median CPI from the Cleveland Fed, which is still, 7% plus. That's still a high number. So I know there are a lot of numbers. CPI is still 6%. I don't know what the nowcast forecast is for the Cleveland Fed. Maybe one of you guys can look that up while we're on, because we'll get those numbers next week for the CPI, what their forecast is. But still, John, there's a lot of inflation in the system, which is killing wages and living standards and so forth. Food prices are still very, very strong. You look at food a lot. I mean, I think that, if the Fed throws a towel in, that would be a huge mistake, just a huge mistake.
I think that's right. So what we've been seeing is that particularly the month-to-month median inflation hasn't come down at all. It has been 0.4% since September. Mm-hmm. It went up to 0.6% in January, but we can just ignore that. Let's say that was a year-end fluke. Or beginning of the year fluke. So now we have basically steady median inflation. If you look at the Cleveland Fed nowcast, that's predicting core CPI of 0.45%. So again, no real change in the in core numbers. It's predicting around the same for April. I mean, it's very early to look at the April number, but what we're seeing is inflation hasn't really come down. We will next week get some deceptive numbers because the headline CPI number will be lower because of the base effect. Remember, last year Putin invaded Ukraine, energy prices went through the roof.
Right.
So we will get some confusing numbers in the headline number, but if you look at some of these underlying measures, you're still going to see inflation is running pretty hot.
Yeah, it's a tricky story. You probably have to watch the 3-month change rather than the 12-month change.
That's right.
Which reminds me, what happens, Mike Falkender, the oil story. So OPEC made its production cut announcement, And both Brent and WTI, they both bumped up about $5. So the West Texas Intermediate is about $80, and Brent crude, your European crude, is about $85. That will be in this number, I guess. Gasoline prices have edged up too, but doesn't? I mean, Mike, how much? What is the oil price threat now with the Saudis and the Russians taking whatever million barrels off the market?
If I remember correctly, though, the OPEC cut was on April 2nd, so it won't be in next week's number.
Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah.
It'll be in the next one. But, you know, even if we look at that three-month number and annualize it, we're still running above 4% inflation. And if we, as the nowcast suggests, come in at 0.4, 0.5 inflation for the month, and you got a 0.3% hourly earnings growth, you've got yet another month of real wage declines.
Mm.
That continues. So even if the 12-month headline number comes down because we lose the oil price increase that we saw 12 months ago upon the invasion of Ukraine, that's going to continue. And it's just going to continue to – the oil price pressure is just going to continue to rise when we start getting into summer driving months.
Mm.
So we've still got more inflation on the horizon. As we've seen, the food inflation persists because the lag of it showing up. Remember, as we talked about before, the fuel then leads to fertilizer, then leads to price increases on food.
Yeah.
And so all of that continues unabated, which is why I question whether, as I said before, whether the Fed can stick with a 2% inflation and target given some of the damages that higher interest rates are doing elsewhere. And so I wonder if that's their out.
I'll tell you, if they give up the target, the 2% target, Jay Powell's going to be smashed, crushed, dissected in his hearings before the House Financial Services Committee. He won't do much better in the Senate either, but the House will just crunch him, absolutely crunch him.
I'm not rooting for it. I'm just saying it's interesting that more people are talking about it.
Well, I like the fact that as a CEO of the largest bank in the United States, he's underwater.
Larry, I think Mike has a very good point here. There's no way they go to – they have to give up the average inflation idea. They liked that when inflation was under and they were like, well, we can get it a little above. There's no way they can actually do average 2% now that we've been above for so long.
Yeah.
Because that would be 1% or less for inflation for quite a while. And they can't get there. I mean, I will just say there's no way to get average down to 2%. What they're really aiming for right now is 2% as a floor. They want to hit that, but they're not going to try to average it anymore. I think that framework is out the window.
Yeah, that was Rich Claret's idea. He's a friend of mine. He's a smart guy, but that was a really lousy idea, average inflation. Anyway, kids, we're going to take a break. We're talking to Michael Faulkner, who's teaching school at the University of Maryland. He was the former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economics. And we got John Carney of Breitbart News. By the way, folks, the Breitbart Business Digest, that is a must-read. Every day, the guy cranks it out, and he's become a regular star on a Fox Business show called Kudlow. Oops, I'm Kudlow. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
I'm Larry Kudlow. Got a little frog in my throat. The pollen count here is like off the charts. I think it's 80. Anyway, we're with Michael Faulkner, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policies, teaching economics at the University of Maryland. He's also the Chief Economist of America First Policy Institute. And the great John Carney from Breitbart News, co-author of the Breitbart Business Digest. So, gentlemen, John Carney, I think I love you. Love, love, love. But I think you're overreacting on the dollar. Let's start with what we know. For some reason, despite Fed tightening, the dollar has been declining almost 15% since October, which is interesting because the Fed's been tightening. And the price of gold has soared almost 20%. It's now over $2,000. So that's a weak dollar. Okay, I get that. But I went back and looked at the, in terms of the big picture, competition from the renminbi, yuan, China, or the BRIC countries, or stuff like that. According to the Bank for International Settlements, 90% of the world's transactions for everything, goods, services, finance, 90% is done by the dollar. I mean, one side is the dollar. It's about $6.6 trillion worth. So I know reserve currency stuff is slipped a bit for central banks, but that's kind of almost a theoretical thing. The reality is everybody wants to use the dollar, whether the dollar is merited or not, because of the mismanagement of fiscal and monetary policy, I don't know. But I don't really see a dollar threat. Or let me put it to you differently. King Dollar, you want to bring King Dollar off his throne. That's because of lousy homegrown policies. In other words, not China. You know, I've met the enemy. The enemy is us. And if we have another 6 years of Joe Biden, there's no telling what will happen. Now, that's the biggest threat.
So what I would say is when I've talked about this, I'm talking about a much longer term change. It's not something that I see coming this year, next year, or, you know, even in the next 5 years. But I do see the world dividing up into trading blocks and therefore currency blocks. One of the reasons that the U.S. One of the reasons for King Dollar is that King Dollar, the U.S. government, has been very generous to the rest of the world. We run trade deficits, you know, against every other country practically in the world. And so one of the things that means is they have lots of dollars, and so they trade amongst themselves. You know, you have countries trading with Saudi Arabia. They're using dollars. There are lots of uses of dollars
in
the world.
John, hang on. Can you guys stay? We're going to have a break. Mike Falkender, John, just stick around. I got to take a quick break, and we'll go another 10, 15 minutes if you have time. Go get a nice cup of coffee, Dunkin' Donuts, that kind of thing. I'm Kudlow. We'll take a break. We're going to back with the King Dollar story and whatever else cooks up.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
All right, welcome back, everybody. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're here with Mike Falkender and John Carney. So go ahead, John. Go ahead. You were trashing the dollar, right? The dollar is going to be replaced by the Chinese renminbi, which has no property rights and capital controls. And then you're going to replace it also by the BRIC countries, which have been around forever, and I doubt it. Not even the euro replaced the dollar. That used to be the argument.
Right. I don't think that they're about to I don't think anything will replace the dollar. I think actually the most successful economies in the world will continue to use the dollar, and all of the free nations of the world will continue to use the dollar. But what we will see, and part of this is, as you said, a result of U.S. policy, although not quite the ones you were naming, which is the U.S. wants to reduce our dependence on China. What this will eventually mean, if we succeed at this, is that China will end up with fewer dollars. China sees that happening, and they are trying to – and by the way, Russia already has no choice. They can't use a dollar system. We've cut them off from that. So China sees that as an opportunity to build something else. And I do think that over the longer term, we will see the world divide into trading blocks where you'll have China trading with Russia and you and some other countries that will be in its orbit. And then that will be a eventual failure. That will not work. And the rest of the world will remain on the dollar system. So what I will say is, yet it's not the dethroning of King Dollar, but it's the rising of a competing kingdom that we are going to witness.
Mike Falkender, what do you think about that, competing kingdoms?
I'm largely in agreement with John in that what will happen is more of the international payments will move into RMB. We already see the Chinese playing a larger role in the Middle East, brokering that deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran. We see that with Russia trying to still sell its oil largely to China, that they're going to be taking RMB instead of dollars. And so as we kind of move to this bipolar world where we've got, as John said, trading blocks that the U.S. and Western countries that have similar labor rights, similar environmental approaches, and that there's a seeking to isolate some of the activities with China, that means that reserve banks are not going to be as dominated in dollars. There's going to be more of a portfolio that's going to also include RMB. So we're going to see ourselves going from 90% of international trade being denominated in dollars to a lower percentage. It's never going to get below, well, certainly not in our lifetimes is it going to get below 50, because for the reasons you mentioned, there's not trust in Chinese economic reports. There are capital constraints on money flowing from China. And so China is not in a position to fully displace the dollar. The euro has had its problem, and no other currency regime is anywhere close enough to provide the liquidity that the dollar does. But it means that reserve banks are going to have more diversified currency portfolios as opposed to being as dominated by dollars as they are today.
You know,
and that's going to slightly weaken the dollar.
Well, okay, but think about this. If you have if you're Brazil or Argentina or Saudi Arabia, put Russia aside for the moment. Russia owns a lot of dollar reserves. They're frozen right now. But if you're increasing renminbi, RMBs, you know, what are you going to invest them in? I mean, because China's not an open system. They have capital controls. And China's the one country that would freeze your reserves. You know, these currency reserves in central banks, those are the family jewels. You know, they own dollars mostly, but they own some gold. They might own some euros. But they're the family jewels. So you invest in RMB, you may never get them back. I mean, they're going to give you, what, Chinese bonds? You may never get them back. In other words, you don't have the kind. And just as a generic point, not only is China run by a communist party, they have no respect for private property rights. They have no respect for private ownership. They don't even have any investment vehicles. I mean, there's very little. We tried, you know, with the U.S.-China trade deal. Mnuchin got a couple of companies in, as I recall, investment companies, but that's all. They didn't want banks. I mean, it's a state-controlled economy. So if you invest,
one of the things
you'll never get your money out.
One of the things that gave rise to U.S. dollar dominance around the globe was actually the U.S. allowing banks around the world, the euro dollar, to be created. In other words, we were free enough with our currency that basically European banks can create dollars. We have, you know, dollar swap lines with central banks all over the world. Mm-hmm. And we've allowed the dollar to become that. The Chinese are never going to give up that level of control. That will limit their, you know, so the Russian central bank is never going to be able to authorize Russian banks to lend in renminbi.
Right.
That's not going a thing that's going to happen. That will limit their ability to, you know, take over as a, you know, as the leading currency of the world. You're absolutely right. Plus, nobody is ever going to trust the Chinese government the way that they trust the U.S. government, in part because they don't have an independent central bank. We actually do have an independent central bank. They answer to the leader of China and the Communist Party.
Yeah, I know, so that's important. And they have no respect for property rights. Property rights include financial instruments. So if you own you have RMB in your portfolio, let's say you're the Central Bank of Brazil, for argument's sake, or the Central Bank of South Africa or something, you know, you can own RMB, but you don't know that you'll ever get it. China will freeze that. If you do one thing they don't like, it's a communist-run central bank. I mean, look, I knew the guy that ran it for a bunch of years. He was a good guy. They got rid of him because he was too independent. He tried to have independence, and they chopped his head off, metaphorically. They didn't actually chop his head off, but they replaced him. So that's why I'm so skeptical. But I will say this, you know, Mike Falconer, if we keep spending and borrowing and deficit and debt and taxes and regulations, if you take our economy down, the dollar, which is weakening right now again, despite higher rates, that'll do great damage to King Dollar, just in terms of the, you know, foreign exchange markets. It'll do great damage to the dollar. That's my biggest concern. It isn't that, you know, it won't be dethroned as the world's reserve currency, but, you know, people won't want to hold dollars. So, the value of the dollar will come down and the inflation rate will go up because everything's priced in dollars. That's the biggest problem I see it.
Right. And as we keep running these deficits, we're just going to keep flooding the market with ever more dollars in order to finance it. And so, yes, that's going to bring down the dollar. I agree with you that there are always going to be concerns about how much long-term RMB-denominated securities you hold because you don't know whether or not you're actually going to be able to get that money back. But as more trade takes place in RMB, there is going to be some portion of reserves that are currently held in dollars that will shift over to RMB in order to facilitate some of that just day-to-day, month-over-month trade with China. You know, if I were Brazil and I were receiving, or if I were Saudi Arabia and I were receiving Chinese dollars for purchases of Saudi Arabian oil, how much would I just buy Saudi products immediately versus how much would I hold RMB-denominated securities? I probably wouldn't want the RMB securities for very long because, as you said, they on a whim can just decide that they're not going to pay it back.
So, but
there is going to be a lot of contemporaneous trade with some RMB sitting in reserve to facilitate that just, you know,
we're still running. I mean, despite the hostility with China, we're still running almost a $400 billion trade deficit with China. I mean, I hate to say it, but the phase one U.S.-China trade deal, there's no appreciable difference that I can find. And we put a lot of export controls, obviously, on technology-related stuff because those are the family jewels and, you know, military and national security. But, you know, Mike Falconer, we're still running close to $400 billion.
What I always remind people of is that, remember, the current account deficit is equal to the capital account surplus.
Yes.
And as long as we keep running multi-trillion dollar deficits, the portion that is not financed by greater money supply, because the Fed has brought way down money supply growth recently, which means all of it's getting financed. And so to the extent that it's financed, And we have a very low personal savings rate in the U.S., which means it's got to come from abroad that you're financing the budget deficit. And some of that's going to come from China. And so rather than buying our goods, they're going to buy our financial securities, and that creates a current account deficit.
Yep, absolutely right. That's a really key point. There's two sides to that trade. The current account is the capital account, and then there's the trading account. Very important point. All right, kids, you're terrific for staying over. John Carney of Breitbart Business Digest, and Michael Falconer, University of Maryland, and the America First Policy Institute, formerly top economist at the Treasury Department. I'm Kudlow. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about Janet Yellen's fanciful plan to send out IRS agents all across the country. Beware, folks. The IRS is coming after you. I'm Kudlow.
Hi, it's Ernie Anastas. You know, your thoughts can affect how you feel, and how you feel can impact your thoughts. Addressing your mind and body connection is the key to improving your overall wellness. Bergen New Bridge Medical Center is the largest hospital in New Jersey, providing comprehensive, equitable, compassionate, and high-quality emergency inpatient and outpatient medical care, plus mental health services and substance use disorder treatment. The Bergen New Bridge team can address your total health needs in one convenient location. Call 201-225-7130. For an appointment, or newbridgehealth.org.
Larry Kudlow. Now back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Great pleasure to be with you. So there's a story out there. It's really interesting. My pal Ira Stahl, futureofcapitalism.com, and he writes for the New York Sun. There's a fabulous story out there where Joe Biden and his Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, and they're cooking up this IRS plan, okay? They're going to spend $80 billion, right? That was in the Inflation Reduction Act, the so-called misnamed Inflation Reduction Act. $80 billion. I don't know how many new IRS agents they want to put in there, like 75,000, 80,000, I don't know. But get this. They are assuming that over the next 10 years, this is a budget item, over the next 10 years, these new IRS agents are going to find $7 trillion of unpaid taxes or uncollected tax revenues, right? $7 trillion. So it's over $600 billion per year. This is just incredible. And there's no evidence of this. There's a couple of papers that they're relying on, academic papers, that, by the way, don't really say that, but the Treasury is trying to make them say that or trying to interpret them to say that. But they don't definitively show anything. This is just all hypothetical nonsense. Hypothetical nonsense. And then of the $7 trillion, of the $7 trillion that they think they're going to collect, they're going to use the money. This is from Yellen. They're going to use the money to spend on climate change, other social welfare benefits, and then curbing prescription drug prices. So they're going to substitute government subsidies, I guess, because of cutting drug prices, which was initiated in the Inflation Reduction Act and elsewhere. Now, who do you think? They say constantly, they say, that they being the Yellens and the Bidens and that crowd, they say that they're going to go after wealthy people who are, you know, dodging their taxes, right? Evil rich people. Evil rich people. But the reality is, every time this has been tried, every time, it isn't the rich who get hit. It's the middle class and the lower class. Okay. Now that number $7 trillion is a fantasy. $7 trillion in uncollected tax revenues. It's an absolute fantasy. All right. Absolute fantasy. But the reality is, and this has been proven, you've had estimates from the right of center tax foundation and the left of center, Brookings Institute Tax Policy Center. They have said many times that the people that are going to get hit the most are not the rich. It's going to be the middle and lower middle income people. Right? They're the ones. Okay. The reality is you couldn't possibly collect $7 trillion from just the wealthiest people, which, by the way, so-called uncollected revenues has to do with things like capital gains taxes, which are unrealized, right? You don't pay the capital gains, which the Bidens, by the way, have jacked up the capital gains tax, even though it's dead on arrival in the House. Okay, it's not going to happen. But if right now you don't pay capital gains unless you sell an asset, right? And then you pay the tax on the sale. They want to double the tax roughly from 20 to 40%. In fact, in some cases, it'll be higher than that. It'll be about 45% because of the surcharge on the very richest of the rich. But you don't pay that. The only place they're going to find stuff is lower middle class people. All right. Wage and salary earners, people that own their own small businesses, like Chapter S, wholly owned proprietorships. I know some of those are big companies, but so many of them are small businesses. You know, they're like electricians, carpenters, people, Ubers, that kind of thing. These are not rich people, and they might make a mistake in their tax forms, or they didn't file something they should have filed. But those are the ones that the IRS always winds up going after. These are folks that don't have fancy lawyers. They don't have the highest priced tax accountants. It's the middle class folks that will always get hurt the most. And this idea that there's $7 trillion of uncollected revenues out there, okay? All right. You finally found Tomas? Tomas Phillipson's University of Chicago, you finally showed up. I don't know. I was having fun talking about this. He was the chief head of the President Trump's Council of Economic Advisors. So, Tomas, I don't know where the hell you were. But actually, I want you to weigh in on this. This is this idea. It's what I've been talking about. We can get to prescription drugs in a minute. But the idea here is In the Biden budget and Janet Yellen, they feel they have $7 trillion of uncollected tax revenues. All right, so over $600 billion per year for the next 10 years, and they're going to take this money and spend it on stuff like climate change or curbing prescription drug prices or other social welfare programs. And they're going to find this $7 trillion, Tomas Phillipson, from rich people, right? Only the richest people are going to pony up. Now, what do you think of this? I mean, this is a massive boondoggle spending plan they have through the IRS, you know, which is getting an $80 billion new budget. What do you think of that, Tomas Phillipson?
Well, I think the issue is, I think, the debt that this is going to incur, right? So they are basically, with the spending they want, they are scheduled to go from roughly 100% of debt held by the public to ballparkish 200% of the debt of the GDP held by the public. So we go from 100 to 200% of GDP of debt. Mm. Now, if you think about how much taxes do you need to just stay afloat at 100%, you would need 10% of GDP per year just to stay at 100% of GDP to avoid going to 200, right, for 10 years, right? 10 times 10 is 100. Mm-hmm. So you need 10% of GDP to collect an extra revenue to stay at 100% of GDP. Now, how much is that relative to what we currently collect? We collect about 20% currently of GDP. In taxes. That would be a 50% increase in tax revenue to just stay afloat at 100% of GDP in debt. And that's the real issue in terms of the spending that they're planning.
Which we won't. We're not,
yeah,
I mean, the way they're going.
No, there's no chance.
We're going to 150%, maybe more. But look at this. These numbers, GDP is about $26 trillion. Federal government spending last year, 2022, was $6.3 trillion. It's going to be close by their own budget. It's going to be close to $7 trillion this year. They want another $7 trillion in uncollected tax revenue, which, Tomas, they then believe they will spend. This is the part I love. They could never get this through Congress, but they think they're going to find this revenue, hold on to it, not go to Congress, hold on to it, and spend it on more climate change, curbing prescription drug prices, and more social welfare benefits without work requirements. This is from a great piece by my pal Ira Stahl, who writes for the New York Sun, and his own website is futureofcapitalism.com. Where's that, Tomas Phillipson, where's that $7 trillion going to come from? Whose number?
No, I mean,
that's a made-up number.
I call Democrats selective economists because they think incentives matter when it helps them, but they don't think incentives matter when it hurts them. So the tax base, if you're going to do this on the rich, is going to shrink dramatically. There's no way they're going to be able to collect this on the rich, right? So incentives matter for them. When we, let's say, expand welfare program, then a lot of more people go on the rolls because it's cheaper, et cetera. Then incentives are really important. But when it comes to taxes, it's not incentives. Incentives are not important, according to these guys, because the tax base, they assume, is going to remain the same when you tax people more.
Well, it won't.
And that's,
it's going to fall.
Yeah, no, but it's selective economics. It's selective economics to basically enforce whatever view you have, and thinking that incentives only operate on one side of the ledger when you spend, but not on the other when you tax.
Yeah, it'll shrink the economy. Anyway, Tomas Phillipson, University of Chicago, former CA chair. We had to wake him up to find him. I'm Kudlow. We're going to come back on the other side of the break. We're going to talk about the stock market on the other side of the break. Go back to sleep, Tomas.
Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. You can live stream us on the internet, by the way. LarryKudlowShow.com, LarryKudlowShow.com. Be heard all across the country, around the world, throughout the solar system and the Milky Way. And by the way, join us on Fox Business Network Monday through Friday, 4 to 5 p.m. every day. The name of the show is Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m. And if you can't hear us at 4, then just text your favorite 9-year-old, and she will show you how to DVR the show. So let's do some stock market work. Great fun, I guess. Stocks were kind of nothingheimer this week, pretty close to flat. Gold is strong. The dollar is weak. Interest rates came back. No. I am wrong. Interest rates fell all across the spectrum. The 10-year note, 3.39. How about that? With an inflation rate of somewhere between 4 and 6%. Anyway, let's go to our distinguished guest, Jack Baruzin, chairman of the Global Smart Commodity Group, and Jeff Kilberg, CEO of KKM Financial and Notre Dame Football, or something like that. Anyway, gentlemen, welcome. Let's go do interest rates. What's going on here? Jack Baruzin, what's interest? So I got a deeply inverted yield curve. 3-month Treasury bills, 4.75. The Fed funds rate, what's the Fed funds rate? 4.75 to 5. I got a 2-year note just below 4. I got a 10-year note at 3.39. And I got a 30-year bond at 3.61. That's very deeply inverted yield curve. What does that mean, Jack? What's that mean, and how long is it going to last?
Larry, I was always taught that the bond traders were smarter than the stock traders. that was the one thing that was always pressed into my mind at all times. And the reason was because there's a lot more debt out there than there really is in equity exposure, if you think about it in the grand scheme of things. The other part of that equation is that you have got a very, very tricky situation. You've got monetary policy and fiscal policy that are diametrically at odds with one another. Mm. You have got a Fed that is draining and tightening and trying to fight inflation, and you've got policy coming out of D.C. that is stepping on the accelerator and spending trillions. Mm. That is creating a very uncomfortable situation for the market. Now, you know, people say, well, with the markets rallying, yeah, but that yield curve is telling you something. It's telling you that something is going to break. Yeah. Again, I don't know what it is. I don't know when it's going to be. But the longer that the yield curve stays inverted like that, the more dangerous it gets for the equity market. And you know, that's the one thing that concerns me about the fixed income market more than anything else right now.
That's an interesting point. Something's going to break, Jeff Kilberg. This is a very strange situation. And to me, it's got a lot of risk in it. But markets, you know, markets are markets. So what do you make of this? Is something going to break? Are we talking banks? Are we talking companies? What are we talking about here?
Well, I think it's a 1-2 punch. And Jack is right, for sure, that, you know, the bond market does provide leadership. And the smartest guys, being Jack and myself, who traded bonds at the Chicago Board of Trade, we like to say we're the smartest guys. But nonetheless, Larry, I think what we're seeing in the yield curve, it's been dramatic. And we're in a historic moment in time. We've never seen the rate normalization process that the Fed induced. Because, and why did they have to raise rates so high in such a dramatic, spastic manner? Because they had rates at zero for too long. They were buying assets up until, you know, February of 2022. So this is the Fed's mistake. We put way too much faith in the Fed. Mm. The Fed talked about inflation being transitory. But what I think actually is going to break, and I think you're going to disagree, so I'm just going to get everyone ready for this. But I think actually inflation is breaking. I think it's going to abate faster. And that's the 1-2 punch we saw. The 2-year note, which was above 5%, tucked under 4%. The 10-year note actually traded 3.25%, almost a full 100 basis points lower than where it's been. So I think it's a 1-2 punch with Silicon Valley Bank and some of the regional banks. I'm not going to call it a crisis. I think it was isolated. It was horribly mismanaged treasury books by a bunch of novice bond traders. But I think inflation, and the data needs to support this, I think inflation is breaking, and that's what's going on. But I actually am more cautiously optimistic about equities because the interest rate Treasury curve is coming lower. It's going to allow some of these tech names to continue to run in 2023.
Well, look, I don't necessarily disagree that inflation is going to break. I think it's been coming down. The question, I suppose, is the timing of it. But, Jack, the question is, if you're basically going from 9% inflation plus, 9-plus inflation, you're somewhere around 4% or 5%, maybe 6% now, I don't know. But let's say inflation continues to come down. What is the economic impact of that? What is the earnings, profits impact of that?
It's real simple, Larry. The market's way too expensive then. Mm-hmm. You're going to see earnings retraction. You're going to see a multiple retraction. It's inevitable. And look, what you just described is a disinflationary spiral, which is probably one of the Fed's biggest nightmares. It's 1990s Japan. You know, believe it or not, a stagflation scenario might be the best of all possible worlds for us coming out of this, you know, this ridiculous situation that the Fed and DC have created for us. So I guess the real question is, you know, and by the way, Jeff, you're spot on. You know, if you look at some of these commodity markets, and Jeff and I are very sensitive to them, you see that. You look at natural gas. It's moved from $9 to $2.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at lumber now, you know, back down to $4. You look at some of these commodities, copper back down to $4. These are the commodities that everybody was complaining about. Soybeans. You've got more soybeans being flooded out of Brazil into China over the course of the last month than ever before in history.
Hmm.
Now, that hasn't even hit the markets yet, but it's telling you something. It's telling you that supply chains are changing, but more importantly, they're intact. And what you just described, that disinflationary scenario is more than likely going to hit the top and bottom line of most corporations. And if that's the case, again, we're looking at a PE on the S&P 500 that is probably 10 to 20% too high.
Mm. What about oil, Jeff?
Well, we kind of saw that one coming as soon as someone from the administration stated that they weren't going to buy oil the next couple of years. So we kind of saw that one coming from a mile away. We knew that prices were going to go higher as soon as we have administration folks starting to trade crude oil futures. But nonetheless, I think that, you know, that was kind of a smack in the face. But it really speaks to the fact that oil is going to continue to move higher.
Mm.
I really have a hard time measuring it, and I don't know how the rest of the investment community is measuring this reopening of China, specifically with all the political tensions going on. But I do think the demand part of the equation will also keep oil stabilizing above $80. But right here, right now, it really kind of reveals the fact that we are not going to see oil go much lower, either politically driven or demand driven.
Well, I mean, Jack, you got people talking about $100 oil because of the OPEC Plus production cuts. $100 oil with a weak economy doesn't make sense to me. And,
no, it doesn't make sense.
I mean, the OPEC doesn't always get it right. I mean, they haven't, because of our stupidity, and we've shut down the fossil fuel spigots, we've given them too much damn power. I get that. So you got $5 jump right after the announcement of the production cutbacks. What was it, 1 million barrels a day plus? But you got all these people talking about 100. How do we get to 100 in a weak economy?
Well, first of all, it's not going to happen unless you're a big oil bull and you're living back in the 1970s again. And
yeah,
that you know, OPEC has got that kind of power. First, here are a couple of little, you know, misunderstood things about OPEC. Number one, it's an illegal cartel. Yeah, number two, you know, they are notorious for cheating amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They really do not care. Okay. And number three, you have got probably one of the biggest off OPEC producers, all right, which is Russia, doing these off Platts transactions. They're flooding the market in ways that we don't even know. And that's how they're supplying their war against Ukraine. So if you factor all of that in, you can really see that there's this battle taking place in oil. The other thing I'll say about oil, by the way, and Jeff kind of touched on it, you know, the Biden administration came out originally when they started to take out the SPR and say that they were going to buy it back at $65 and lower. Well, you know how low oil got? It got down to $65.17.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Because all of us had our bids, and I'm sure Jeff did too. We all had our bids in at $65, knowing that these idiots told us they were going to start buying it at $65. All right? Instead of going out and buying it and then announcing that they had started replenishing the SPR. So, again, sometimes you feel as if idiots are running our government. I mean, I hate to say it that way.
Oh, gee.
But, you know,
shucks.
But I'm going to come right out.
Oh, Jack.
It's killing me.
Oh,
it's
gee whiz.
Me. You know, a little common sense would go a long way.
Oh, you're so tough on them. You mean socialism doesn't work?
Well, here in Chicago, we just elected a communist. A socialist would be a step up.
How the hell did you guys? All right, let's talk about that for a minute, okay? I know it has nothing to do with the stock market. Jeff Kilburg, how did this happen in Chicago? It's such a – I love Chicago. When I was with Bear Stearns for so many years, we had a huge office in Chicago. I'd go out there six, seven, eight times a year. I loved it. I'd walk up North Michigan Avenue, one of the greatest shopping – maybe the best shopping place in the whole United States. I love staying at those lovely hotels, the Ritz-Carlton and the Four Seasons. What the hell? How could you guys, you elected somebody that's going to bring the whole city down? It's like the death of Chicago.
You know what, Larry, it's so perplexing, but it's just so disheartening. Chicago, born and raised in Chicago. Chicago is just a beautiful, beautiful place.
Yes.
We took a ton of pride, you know, revamping Lincoln Park and the zoo and the lakefront back in the 90s and 2000s. And it's just so sad to see what's transpired. And when you talk about it, we'll see if it comes to fruition. They're talking about raising taxes. You worry about the debt downgrades on the municipal bonds associated with the state of Illinois and state of Chicago. If we see this upgrade in tax collection, because we know companies and corporations are going to be running for the hill. They're actually talking about instituting a $1 to $2 security tax.
Mm-hmm.
What few traders are left and what's left of the CBOE, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, see in Florida. I mean, Jack, get the sunscreen, right? Here we go, because it's just so disheartening to see what's transpiring.
The teachers union financed this guy. The most left-wing, I swear, the teachers union is the most left-wing socialist cancel culture aspect of this country right now. That's what this going on. And that poor guy, he was kind of like a pseudo Republican. What was the final? Was it 51-49? Was that the final tally?
It was 51-49. And when you talk about the teachers, remember, this is a guy that spent 4 years as a teacher and is getting a full pension.
Mm.
All right.
4 years.
And that is really the thing about Chicago that people don't understand. The layering of pensions. That's how, and the entitlements. And it is one of the things that is killing. And it's also, can I tell you what? In another few years, there'll be a textbook written about the failure of progressive politics.
Oh, yeah.
Chicago will be a case study.
I'm going to co-author it. I'm going to co-author that book.
What we have seen over the course of the last 4 years, all right, when Rahm Emanuel passed over the city, and I thought Rahm was pretty extreme to the left, but he was trying hard. But when he turned the city over to Lori Lightfoot put it on life support, all right, this guy is actually going to pull the plug.
Yeah, this guy's to the left. He's to the left.
We're not even talking about the violent crime issues. I mean, that's going to be amplified moving forward. Hard to believe it could increase in the city of Chicago.
How far?
But, unfortunately.
How far is South Bend, Indiana from Chicago?
That's Jeff's hometown.
Notre Dame will survive, Jeff. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. Marcus Freeman has the direction going right.
All right. We got to take a quick break. I know it doesn't have anything to do. We don't care if stock markets, Chicago politics, whatever. Jack Baruzian is the chairman of the Global Smart Commodity Group. Jeff Kilburg is the CEO of KKM Financial. They're both very old and dear friends of mine. I'm Kudlow. We'll be back. I want to talk about high gold and a low dollar. Next up on Kudlow.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show. Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're here with Jack Baruzian, chairman of the Global Smart Commodity Group, and Jeff Kilburg, CEO of KKM Financial. Start with Jack. Dollar down, gold up. I can think on the chart since late October or some such, the dollar's off almost 15%, gold up nearly 20%. I got gold at 2007 closing on Friday. That's a big number for gold. And the dollar, what's the dollar? 102. It's not the worst thing in the world, but it was as high as about 113, 114. So what's going on, Jack?
Two things are driving this. I mean, you know, obviously the negative correlation between the dollar strength and or weakness, I should say, and the price of gold going up. I mean, that's something to expect and remember. Things are dollar denominated for those that don't understand out there. So, if the dollar goes down and everything stays the same, in turn, it essentially goes up in value in dollars. So that's one of the things that we see happening. The other thing is a little bit more detailed and a little bit more nefarious, believe it or not. There's an arbitrage taking place. Yeah. You know, we talk about how, China and Russia and everybody's now starting to use renminbi. They're starting to use, whatever. They're using something outside of the dollar. No, they're not.
Mm.
What they're doing is they're doing an arbitrage immediately for gold. And gold is becoming a currency.
Yeah, wow.
So that's the way people are accepting the renminbi out there. That's the way they're accepting a ruble out there. They are basically taking no risk if they can, and they're immediately taking an arbitrage into gold. Now, as long as we see that taking place, there's going to be a floor for gold and a demand for gold, even if we see dollar strength. Mm. So, I'm a fan of gold right now.
That is so interesting. Right. So they get renminbi or rubles, and they get out of them and go into gold.
Think about it. If you're BP, would you want to hold renminbi or rubles?
Right.
Of course not.
There's...
And even if you're going through a second or third arm, which in many cases they are, you make sure that the conversion and the arbitrage takes place before it comes back home.
Jeff Kilberg,
a lot of sense.
You like gold?
No, Larry. I do, but, quick question or a quick observation that really kind of explains Jack's explanation of gold, explains the disconnect in silver. The last time we saw gold up around 2000, silver was $37. Silver's trading at 25, so that disconnect is absolutely explained. But I think it's just fascinating to see people are really struggling to get a better understanding. They started buying treasuries hand over fist. The dollar index, to your point, came lower. Mm. And here we are going into earnings seasons, right? We have earnings season. You're going to see the banks, which are kind of battered and bruised, kicking off this Friday. But we have 25 days until the next Fed meeting. So here we are back in this conundrum trying to better understand where can you find a bit of a safe haven? Because the safe haven really has been who moved my cheese? We're trying to figure out where the actual safe haven is. But I do like gold there. I think there's more room to run. But it is interesting to see silver at such a deep discount here at $25. Maybe there's an opportunity for silver to kind of high tide rise all boats.
Last one, the best performing asset I can find year to date, up 68.7%, is... ready for it? Bitcoin. 27,897 Bitcoin. Lode, you buying Bitcoin, Jack Berusian?
I'm not. And for those that have got it, God bless. Hope you enjoy it. Hope you enjoy the ride up, enjoy the ride down. It's like riding a roller coaster. You won't see me on one of those ever again.
Jeff, Bitcoin and the Notre Dame Endowment, Bitcoin?
Look, I love the Golden Dome, but Bitcoin, I think you kind of cherry-picked that number from year to date. You look at a 1 year, it's down 50%, Larry, so no Bitcoin for me right now. Like blockchain, though.
All right, fellas, you're both terrific. Jack Berusian and Jeff Kilberg. Folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we have Monica Crowley and Liz Peek to talk money and politics. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to talk some money and politics. We've got Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist, and we've got Monica Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury and the author of the Monica Crowley podcast. Welcome, kids. I appreciate it very, very much. So I just want to start about the Trump after his indictment and after his speech at Mar-a-Lago. Anyway, Liz Peek, his polls continue to skyrocket. I saw some new stuff today. He's now up about 35 points in at least some polls against DeSantis, and he's also taken a lead against Biden. Now, is this stuff going to last? And I'm particularly interested in the DeSantis story. He gave a good speech Tuesday night, made some very important points. But what do you think about this story? How does this change the race?
Well, I mean, it changes it pretty profoundly, I'd say, because an awful lot of people in America thinks there are two systems of justice, one for people on the left and one for people on the right. And what we witnessed last week with the indictment of Donald Trump on truly frail and unworthy charges kind of reinforces that view. I mean, people think this was vastly unfair. Obviously, he's raised, what, $8, $9 million now off the back of this indictment. But I think more importantly, again, people across the country, whether they like him or hate him, I think they just thought, wait a minute, this is going too far. We know you hate Donald Trump, but really this is how this is going to play out in our justice system. So it has given him a platform. Donald Trump thrives on grievance and also on vengeance. I mean, I think he is really angry about this. I would be too. It has stirred up his base, and I don't know that that's going to go away anytime soon.
Interesting. You know, Monica, I thought he gave a good speech. It is his grievance, but, you know, on the two-tiered system that Liz mentioned, I mean, one of the ideas here that Trump is saying is, you know, this happened to me, but it can happen to you. It can happen to you. And I think that's pretty powerful stuff. So I wondered, this really enters a whole new dimension into the GOP primary.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, Larry. And it's great to be here with you and Liz. Look, Donald Trump is a unique political phenomenon in American political history, and certainly in this moment. And one of his many superpowers is that he was able from the very beginning to forge an organic emotional bond with his voters, with the American people. Now, some people absolutely hate him, but a lot of people absolutely love him. And why is that? Because back in 2015 and 2016, he looked at the forgotten men and women in this country, and he said something very profound. He said, "I see you, I hear you, and I will be your champion." And then for the next 4 years as president, he actually delivered for these people. And that's why that emotional bond, remember, this is not a political bond with Donald Trump or even an intellectual one. It's an emotional one. That is almost unbreakable. And it happened because it's organic, too, which also makes it even stronger. That is why every single time he is hit like this, he gets stronger, because it's the human response to want to rally around their champion and give him some backup, because they feel like he has fought for them for the last 7 or 8 years, and now they're going to step up and fight for him. So again, you know, that the left can't not do it, right? They cannot help themselves. They know throughout the last 7 or 8 years, every time they hit him, it only strengthens him and burnishes his appeal. But they can't stop themselves. And now what's happening is that he is so far ahead of his nearest competitor, Governor DeSantis. I'm not quite convinced that DeSantis is actually going to get in the race now.
I want to.
A million things could happen and the dynamics could change.
Right.
But as of this moment, Larry, it looks like Donald Trump is cruising to the nomination.
I want to come back to DeSantis in a minute. But a question I get, it's funny, I always kid this. They should move the jury because there are no Republicans in Manhattan County, New York City, except for five or six of us that have dinner at an Italian restaurant every week. And we had our dinner at the Italian restaurant on Wednesday after the Tuesday stuff. And the question that came up was, can Mr. Trump get to 51% in the general election, or, you know, 50.1%, whatever? Can he get there, Liz?
Well, that's the question. And I think that's what Republican primary voters have to wonder about and worry about, that, yes, he's going to win the primaries maybe quite easily, but then aren't those unfavorables and the really solid core of Democrats who just loathe him going to keep him from winning? I mean, what he has going for him is now they pretty much loathe Joe Biden as well. If Joe Biden is the candidate, right now he is not polling well with anybody. there's not going to be any great surge of enthusiasm for Joe Biden. He can't go out campaigning on his own behalf. So, you know, I think he's going to play, you know, we've talked about this. I think he's going to play out pretty much what he did in 2020, which is to sort of stay out of sight, let Trump create his own problems for himself, and hope voters decide that they're better off under Joe Biden. But that's the problem, Larry, for Joe Biden right now. We're not better off than we were 4 years ago. Very few people would say that. In 2020, he was sort of an unknown quantity in terms of how effective a president he would be. Now we know he's a terrible president, and America is suffering on all fronts. And that's why his approval ratings have just been stuck in the garage. And, you know, I think that's where we're going to be.
Well, no, I mean, you know, Monica, in 2020, I don't know, Liz, somebody called it the basement strategy.
Yeah.
But people, you know, hoped he would be more Bill Clinton, I, you know, a.k.a. moderate Democrat. But without question now, we know he was Bernie Sanders. And he ran against Bernie Sanders, and people, Democrats, were relieved. But we know he's Bernie Sanders. Now, that changes the race, it seems to me, and it greatly weakens Biden's whole position.
Yeah, because when he ran in 2020, he was able to pull the wool over everybody's eyes and position himself as some sort of moderate. And, of course, he was never a moderate, and he's certainly not a moderate in terms of governing as president. So the question is, how do they keep him back in the basement for the next campaign if, in fact, he's going to run? I'm not convinced he's running. I think he put off this announcement until the fall because I think the only person who believes he's running is Joe Biden. So now we're going to have to look at a different Democratic landscape. But look, all of the energy and activism are on the radical left in that party. The Joe Manchins of the world are few and far between because the party has had a wholesale takeover of these insane Marxists. And that's where all of the driving forces are on the left.
What?
So even if Biden runs again, he could very well be primaried by somebody on the left. I'm not saying AOC, but maybe somebody like that, or maybe even her. I don't know.
Well,
but there is a civil war going on the left as well as on the right.
Before we take a break, Liz Peek, does Robert F. Kennedy Jr. cause Biden trouble?
Huh.
He might.
Well,
do you know Bob Kennedy? I know him some. He used to come on my old CNBC show. He's no dummy, by the way.
Well, he's no dummy. He has a really interesting, obviously very controversial view of vaccines and how we treated COVID. That's going to be a problem for Joe Biden because it's pretty hard for Joe Biden to argue that his one area where he gets positive approval ratings, which is on handling COVID, was actually a disaster. Our deaths per 1,000 Americans are worse than any other developed country. And by the way, it got worse when Joe Biden took over, even though we had a vaccine. So I think if that conversation goes public, which it really never has, that could cause Joe Biden a lot of problems.
I was talking to Kevin Hassett, whether we should go talk to Bob Kennedy Jr. And get him to endorse his uncle's tax cuts, the JFK tax cuts.
Yeah, good idea.
Okay. I know it's a little fanciful, but we were having that conversation. Let me take a quick break, ladies. Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist, Monica Crowley, former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, and author of the Monica Crowley podcast. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're talking money and politics with Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist, and Monica Crowley, former assistant treasury secretary and author of the Monica Crowley podcast. Monica Crowley, what does Ron DeSantis do now?
Well, isn't that the million-dollar question, right? look, he's got this massive war chest of upwards of $200 million just sitting there waiting to be used. And I think he's playing it very smart, and I think he's played it very smart all along because he understands Donald Trump is still the 800-pound gorilla in the Republican Party. And now with this indictment, it's really poured rocket fuel on the Trump campaign for 2024. So I think DeSantis is being very wise to hang back, wait. The legislature is still in legislative session in Florida, so he is busy actually governing the state, and he's in this battle again with Disney. So he is taking care of his day job, but I think he's smart to just hold back and see how all of this is going to shake out. As we said before the break, the dynamics are very fluid here with Trump and this particular indictment, but let's not forget there are a number of other investigations, including DOJ, January 6th, Georgia, and they could actually hit Trump with maybe two or three additional indictments coming down the pike. And that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. So, look, if I'm Ron DeSantis, I've got enough money where I don't have to get out there early and start fundraising. I can afford to wait. But he's also going to be paying very close attention to these poll numbers, Larry. And he's seeing that Donald Trump is really taking off. And he doesn't want to poison himself for the future.
Liz, I'm now anointing you chief political strategist for the DeSantis campaign.
Yeah.
Chief political strategist. There are issues that he could take up, okay? One of the issues is remember the New York versus Florida, the Wall Street Journal editorial, which I wrote up on a whole bunch of people. You know, you live in Miami.
Yeah.
Your tax rate is zero. You live in New York, it's 14.8. Florida grows faster. Florida's population is higher than New York, but the budget is 50% less than New York. I've not heard DeSantis talk about any of that stuff. And I just wonder, I understand he's in a pickle right now, and Monica's probably right. He's going to wait out the legislative session. But shouldn't he be trying to develop a prosperity, economic growth message? I mean, wouldn't that help him? He's got one tailor-made, but he never talks about it. I don't think the battle with Disney is going to particularly help him.
Well, I totally agree with you. And, in fact, when he goes into this anti-woke stance, which he's really pushed very, very hard, I think that must be to gain ground with Trump voters and sort of the hard right, and perhaps he's looking at the primaries. But you know what? That some of that stuff's going to cost him in the general election, I think. And, boy, I think what you're talking about is absolutely the way to go right now, because not only he has the goods, he's got the message and the experience and the resume, which says, hey, I can really run a solid economy. And he talks about things that he's done in office, like, you know, no drama and sort of how we never have leaks and we don't have a lot of turnover. All that's very impressive. But boy, what's more impressive, everyone in New York is going to Florida, and there's a reason for that. Mm. So he should talk about that, especially, Larry, because I think there's really a good chance a lot of this campaign is going to go on with a soggy and declining economy. So that's going to be an awful lot of the battle in 2024 is who has the better economic plan, and Florida does. So why not talk about it?
Yeah, what do you think about that, Mike? I mean, I really think that's DeSantis' best card to play. I don't think fighting Walt Disney and cancel culture, you know, look, he could appear, but that's Trump's base. He's not going to out-Trump on that stuff. He needs to shift gears. Otherwise, maybe you're going to be right, and he just isn't going to run at all. And Nikki Haley will be around, and I don't know, somebody else will be around, but Trump's going to wind up winning the primaries easily.
Look, I think any Republican candidate who's seeking the presidential nomination needs to be talking about an economic agenda. That is a pro-growth economic agenda of tax cuts, regulatory relief, unleashing our great energy sector, fair trade deals. It's basically the Trump pro-growth economic policy. Ron DeSantis has such a record in Florida. Florida is booming. It is thriving thanks to his steady hands on the economic levers of that state. So he's got a great economic story to tell. And honestly, I think that there are going to be many factors that go into this election next year, but the economy is going to be the driving force. Most people expect some sort of a recession by the end of this year going into next year, whether it's mild or deep or protracted or short, nobody knows. But a lot of people are anticipating a softening of the economy. And so this is going to be fertile ground for a pro-growth economic message. People vote on how things directly relate to them. So all of these candidates should be talking economy and how they'd bring this country back. The problem for the rest of them is that Donald Trump has such an extraordinary economic record, thanks to you and others, Secretary Mnuchin and others, that he's got a full advantage on that. Others might have a great track record like Ron DeSantis in a state, but Donald Trump brought the economy back not once, but twice. First when he came in after 8 years of Obama, and then after the unprecedented lockdowns of COVID. So, you know, he can say, look, I did it twice. Here's how I'm going to do it a third time. So, and that message blows everybody else out.
So Liz, I think we have to turn Robert Kennedy Jr. into a JFK supply sider.
Let's have them battling, Larry, on who can go to the lowest tax rates, the best tax program.
Yes.
That's a great idea.
Yes, that's my vision. That's my vision. I don't think anybody else shares that vision, but that's
I think you should have him on the show.
That's,
you know?
Yeah, you know what? I used to talk to him a lot, years ago on the other back at CNBC. It was mostly about climate. He's a big climate guy. Okay. But on these other issues, he may be a whole lot more moderate. He may not be a Bernie Sanders Democrat. That's the interesting thing. I don't know. Right now, he's running to keep New Hampshire as the first in the nation primary. That's his big issue.
I want to just weigh in on one comment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a brand new CNN poll out that shows only a third of Americans say that Joe Biden deserves to be reelected.
Mm.
And we can all talk about all the reasons for that. But you guys are right that he definitely ran as a moderate. He also ran as someone who was going to bring our country together. And I really can't think of a president who's been more divisive, who has been more insulting to people who voted for the other candidate. You know, I think the whole image of Joe Biden has changed. He's not a nice man. And I think, you know, you can look at all the kind of in-depth polls that talk about dishonesty and things like that. I don't think people like him very much anymore.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, Monica, he's a lot. It's funny. All these headlines I saw, how the Democrats covet the fact that Trump is winning the primaries and he's the easiest guy for Biden to beat. You sure? I mean, I'm going to take the under on that.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
Right.
Isn't that true in
life?
It's
right.
Certainly true in politics, right? And look, they thought that Donald Trump was going to be the candidate easily to beat in 2016. Mrs. Clinton was riding high and she was already planning, you know, her second term. And Donald Trump, you know, surprised everybody. So, look, I think the left continues to underestimate Donald Trump. And, you know, they're going to war with him in every possible way, as they have for the last several years, to try to stop him. And, again, I think that only makes him stronger. But I also think that given the faltering economy, you know, you no longer have to go back 40 years to the Reagan era. Also, you were a part of, Larry, for a touchstone of a strong economy. You no longer have to go back in your memory and back in time. You only have to go back 2.5 years to remember a booming economy pre-COVID. And now look at the economic catastrophe that we're facing, which is only going to get worse over the next year and a half. And I think that is really going to play into any Republican's hands. But certainly Donald Trump, I think, has the advantage on that issue.
I think one factor, Liz, Alvin Bragg forgot to charge Trump with a crime. Notice that he forgot the crime part.
He has made sort of a mockery of his entire legal vendetta against Donald Trump. And I think it seriously weakens and undermines the other legal problems that Donald Trump's had. Monica's right. There are a bunch of them coming. And I do think that the strategy of Democrats now is just to keep those headlines coming. The fact that the next hearing in this trial isn't until December sort of says it all, right? I mean, how could possibly that be necessary? Why don't they just get this thing done? Well, they don't want to. They want to have a cascade of indictments and charges and so forth coming out, because that is the only way, I'm sure they think, that Joe Biden can win. I mean, he's going to be kind of under the radar. In fact, the New York Times had a headline the other day about, you know, Team Biden, not thrilled, but it was sort of pleased to be under the radar. Yeah, they should be.
My favorite is the judge. gave $15 to the Democratic Party, to Joe Biden. Yeah. $15. Let's disqualify. Monica Crowley, thank you so much. Liz Peek, as always, thank you. Folks, I'll be back next weekend. I'm Kudlow. Thank you.
Hemorrhoids can be a real pain in the butt, causing anal itching and burning and irritation. Get fast relief with all-natural, doctor-developed and tested Anacool. Buy Anacool, A-N-A-C-O-O-L, on Amazon right now and save 15% with code WABC2024.